And welcome to Equilibrium on CKUT 90.3 FM. This is your host, Ryan Young. Welcome to the show. So today we are going to feature some coverage of what's been going on in BC lately, British Columbia, with the historic floods there, and how a lot of those floods are the result of obviously climate change, but also the practice of clear-cut logging in that province. Something that, you know, is an ongoing issue. But first, we're going to feature a really cool project on the McDonald campus of McGill University out in St. Anne de Bellevue. A group of students working with, I believe, the professor Kyle Elliott have started a project around creating a pollination meadow. So a place for pollinating insects like butterflies and various types of bees to have a higher amount of flowering plants, a higher biodiversity of flowering plants. And they're doing this in an area of the campus, which is not far from the community garden. And the project aims to address the lack of support for native pollinators on the island of Montreal, and more specifically, McDonald campus. The project leader is Alex Kuiper-Dixon, who I spoke to, and I also spoke to one of the project team members, and her name was Patricia Sung. So this report starts off with Alex Kuiper-Dixon hoeing the area that they are preparing to plant seeds in to create this pollination meadow. So this is where we start the story. So I'm here with Alex Kuiper-Dixon, and he is working on a project called the McDonald Campus Pollination Meadow. And this is a project to basically create habitat for pollinators, different types of insects, and you know, all kinds of other added ecological connections that will happen naturally. And what are you doing right now in the project?
Right now, I'm currently just tearing up the dead grass that was killed over the summer with a three-pronged hoe, just to create a nice soil surface for good seed germination. And we've got lots of volunteers doing the same thing here today, tearing up old grass, pulling out any remaining living dandelions as much as we can, and just really preparing everything so that when the seeds start to grow, there's as little competition as possible, so they have the best chance of success.
And what's the size of the area we're in right now?
So the project was planned for about half an acre. We sourced all of our material from all of our tarps that we use to sterilize the ground from farms around the area. So our final area really was dependent on what we could find in terms of tarps. So it's a little less than half an acre now, but that's the rough area, yeah.
And where are we located on the campus? Well, how would you describe it?
Yeah, so when we were originally trying to decide an area where to do this project, we looked at many different lawn zones on campus, and in a communication and collaboration with different professors and people on campus. And this one was decided to be used, this area that's directly next to the McDonald campus community garden, next to the pollination garden and eco residence, because it is a large area of lawn that is not directly in the way, and it is used. There are community members that use it, but compared to the other lawns on campus, it's less used.
What's your name?
Patricia Sung. Alex and I first started the Mac Meadow as a project for one of our classes, and we decided we want to make the proposal actually happen. So we applied for SPF funding, funding from St. Anne de Bellevue, and we basically just wanted to get this into actual action to help increase local biodiversity in the area of native pollinators, since this lawn wasn't really being used before.
Nice. And are you in bioresource engineering as well?
No, I'm in environmental science honors. My concentration is biodiversity conservation. And I'm doing a minor in GIS and remote sensing. So.
Oh, GIS.
Yeah, as well. That's my minor.
Cool. Do you see possible ways to use GIS with a project like this?
Yeah, so GIS is great for so many different applications, but some things you can do is like site monitoring, just like making maps in general are great. Like we could potentially like use the site, like map it using GIS, and then we can put it out on the internet, you know, or different sources for other people to make a similar template kind of thing. GIS is really good for map making.
For sure, for sure. And for our listeners, if you don't know what GIS is, it's geographic information systems. Yeah. So, so today you're just getting rid of the last green plants here.
Yeah. So we basically did this technique of solarization where we put tarps down to naturally like kind of bake or kill most of the grass. But we still have leftover weeds and the dead grass, obviously, to remove. So that's what we're doing today, is basically prepping the site for tomorrow.
Nice. And do you live on campus?
Yeah, I do. I live in Laird Hall. I work there as being part of the Residence Life Committee. Yeah.
Nice, nice. So it's not too far for you to come do this work.
No, exactly, yeah. I live right on campus, so it's easy enough.
Nice. And are you nearing graduation or...?
Yeah, I'm in my last year right now. Next semester hopefully will be my last semester, but this is a project that's been pretty close to my heart. So.
Nice, nice. Well, it's a great project, and it's great to see all the people that came out today to help.
Yeah, for sure. It's so nice having all these people that want to actually spend their Saturday, take a break from studying for finals or big projects, and just get some fresh air and help us make this actually happen.
And I guess there are finals coming up, right?
Yeah, there are. But it's a really nice break. And, you know, it's putting what we're learning in school, like, into application, into use, and making a difference.
Nice. Well, thanks so much for speaking to me.
Yep. Thank you so much, Ryan.
So Alex Kuiper-Dixon is also formerly the environmental advisor for the McDonald Campus Student Society. And, you know, since he's been studying here, he's been involved in a lot of different environmental projects. And why did you take an interest in the environment when you came to study here?
Well, I came to study here because of my interest in the environment. I know that I like being outside. I know that I like working outside with the land. I know that I care about environmental conservation. And I also really like the maths and sciences and solving problems. So bioresource engineering, which was unique to this campus, was an ideal program for me. So I came here because of my interest in the environment, and then when I was here, I found so many opportunities to participate in that work that needs to be done.
And in this pollination meadow project, how did it start? Like, what were the first beginnings like? Where did the idea originally come from and so on?
Yeah, so many of us, talking to our friends, the different people participating in the project or coming here to volunteer today, we all noticed one of the first things when we come to campus is the amount of maintained lawn on campus, much of which does not look like it gets frequent use, like the soccer fields or rugby fields. It's mainly just manicured with not very apparent use, although I guess people around still use it. So that sort of is a little shocking when we come here, going, this is the environmental campus. What's going on with that? And then last winter semester, so winter 2020, I guess, a group of students and I were in this class called Wildlife Conservation with Kyle Elliott as the professor. And it was a project-oriented class where each group was assigned a different project in relation to the Grand Parc de l'Ouest project. And our group, or one of the projects that was available, was designing a pollination meadow for the campus. And when I saw that, I was excited because it's been something I'd been wanting to do for a while, and this was a great opportunity to do it. So we got going on it. And while I was theoretical in class, and none of the other projects in class moved into reality, we decided that because we have this opportunity, we had already spent a semester looking into it, we wanted to actually bring it into reality.
And, you know, when you look at that kind of a project, somebody might say, oh, well, just don't mow the grass for a whole year, and then you'll end up with that just by the course of nature. Why isn't it as simple as that?
Yeah, so that's a valid approach. People do try that, and it definitely is lower cost, lower work input. But it's less ideal because then all of the plants that already exist in that area, a lawn is filled with many non-native grass species that don't provide as much food as they can for the animals, the native animals and other things that live here. So when you just let that grow, it gets tall, it can look nice, but it can also get infested with invasive species like wild parsnip or poison ivy or nettles, even though they're not invasive, but it can end up not being as beneficial as it could be. Whereas the work we're doing for this project of removing those unwanted plants and putting in a high density of flowering species and native grasses will provide a super dense food source for the native pollinators and birds that don't have access to that type of environment because Montreal is so covered in forested areas, but not as many meadow areas.
So it's not just there is a process to it. So what was the first thing you had to do?
So the first thing we did was a lot of research. We wanted to make sure that our steps were good, that we knew what we were doing, consulting with the experts on campus, talking to different students, talking to different experts, suppliers, everything. Because if we were going to do this, we wanted to do it right. And then in terms of implementing the project itself, getting the pollination meadow going, we sourced materials like plastic tarps from farms in the area that they had used for their greenhouses and tarping hay bales and such, and then covered the grass in July in order to sterilize the soil, kill as much of those plants as possible, and so we would have a good soil to be able to put fresh seeds in.
So now, today, pulling out the extra green plants that still remain, and then tomorrow seeding, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's exactly right. The tarps, they, as I said, they were secondhand, so they did have some holes in them that we tried to duct tape, but they didn't work as efficiently as they would have if we had bought them new. So yes, there is still some work to do today of pulling out the green material, and the dandelions just survived like nothing else. They are native and they've got those tap roots for unlimited energy sources. So really they loved it. And we're just pulling out piles and piles of dandelions.
In terms of the seeds, how you chose your species, and finding the right, seed source, was that complicated or was that a learning experience?
Yeah, so different members in our team managed different parts of the project, and one of the members on our team managed the creating the seed lists, which was not myself. So, but their process was they researched all the different types of native flowering plants that grow in this area. We also looked into what type of plants might interfere with nearby agricultural practices, because there were certain ones that we wanted to avoid. And then we created our own lists, and then we found a supplier, and there is not that many large organic seed suppliers in Canada. So we found Wildflower Farms, which produces a lot of organic seed, and they have instructions on how to make meadows. They have put together seed mixes, so we looked at what seed mixes they had available and then asked them to add or remove certain seeds so it could be tailored to our project specifically.
Nice. And where did you get some of your funding from?
Yeah, we've been super, super grateful and lucky with the amount of support we've had for this project. We've gotten a large amount of funding from the Sustainable Project Fund of McGill. We've had funding and support from the St. Anne de Bellevue Moving Towards Sustainability Fund. One of the professor in charge of this project, Kyle Elliott, has a grant that we've been able to access for this project as well. And then we've had donations of materials from different people, lots of labor and volunteer hour donations, which we are so grateful for as well. It would not be possible without all of that non-monetary donation as well. But in terms of monetary donation, the Sustainable Project Fund, Moving Towards Sustainability Fund of St. Anne de Bellevue, and Kyle Elliott's research grant.
Nice. And in terms of, you know, the addiction in North America to nice green lawns and maybe the whole culture of that, in your research, did it make sense to you from an ecological point of view why it's good to at least replace some of the large expanses of green grass that's just mowed on a regular basis on campus?
Yeah, for sure. It's interesting where that cultural point of view of the beauty of this lawn, where that comes from. I think it has something to do with like the Second World War and poverty, and it's a wealth status symbol if you have a manicured lawn without dandelions in it. But it really, lawns are highly consumptive of water resources, of manual resources, of mowing resources, which is fuel or electricity, and they don't provide any services other than a nice material to walk on. They also are less permeable to water, so ultimately they don't do a lot of good and they consume a lot. Whereas a meadow area like this that we're trying to produce, it takes less maintenance in the long run because it's a natural ecosystem. It will need to be mowed maybe once a year. It doesn't require water implementations because these are all plants that have evolved here for centuries, thousands of years, to be able to survive in this climate. So it doesn't take water resources, it doesn't take manual resources, it doesn't take fuel resources, and at the same time it provides food for pollinators, which are so essential in our agricultural production, and it provides food for birds, which are also pollinators, but also manage, like, they're a fantastic pesticide for local agricultural productions to have better biodiversity levels in the area, and the soil also becomes more permeable, so then that decreases flooding.
Very interesting. And being a campus where there are residences around, and you know, some people kind of maybe feel an attachment to the area around them, even though it's not within their rights to control what goes on the campus because it's a public space and so on. Did you have some pushback from people that live in the area?
So people that live around here are very passionate about the land they live on. They're invested in where they live. They've lived here for a long time, and they really care about their immediate area. And that comes through in the type of feedback I've gotten from them. They've seen me working out here in the field, and unfortunately, I made the mistake of not consulting them before the project took place. So they were a little surprised that this was happening. But then the reaction I had was surprise or some feedback about the project and suggestions and sharing their concerns about the work that was being done, which is very valuable to us because we're not experts. We're consulting experts, and some of these people are experts. So if they're able to share their concerns with us, they are living here, so we do want to produce something that they will be happy with, something that they will be proud with, something they will be proud of. So we've been able to take those concerns and try and integrate them into our project as much as possible so that they can feel proud of their immediate environment as well.
Would you say that this project is part of a kind of series of projects that are being looked at for the future on campus, or in maybe some ways it's also a continuation of past projects?
Yes, for sure. A large part of this type of project is collaboration with other similar projects. So there's a habitat creation for insects project going on campus right now who we're collaborating with. We're providing a food source, they're providing habitats. And half of this project is trying to create a chain effect or a butterfly effect of providing a template so that other private homeowners or McGill campus or John Abbott College can pursue similar projects on their own land. This is a pilot project so that more and more we can start to see this happen to create a chain of these native areas for all the species to enjoy.
And are you hoping to get a certification from the David Suzuki Foundation as a butterfly, what is it called, a butterfly way?
Yeah, so the David Suzuki Foundation has this project called the Butterfly Way Project, and we've been collaborating with two of their butterfly rangers throughout the entirety of this project. I'm not 100% sure where that's going to go, but we are hoping to have some kind of correlation with the David Suzuki Foundation because it is similar work that we do.
So the volunteers today, are they from various different classes, or how did a lot of these people hear about coming to volunteer today?
So our social media manager did a fantastic job of broadcasting our message, our project around the entirety of the McGill campus and community. In collaboration with different offices, we were able to post it on many different platforms. So a lot of people, 80 people signed up for our email list in the past week and a half, and 40 people or 30 people signed up to volunteer with us this weekend. And they come, some people came from downtown, some people come from Mac campus, some people come and who live on residence. There are some adults like Pollination, the David Suzuki Butterfly Rangers came and volunteered as well. So people from everywhere came and helped out.
And that makes you happy.
Yeah, very happy. Very grateful for all the volunteers that came with us.
That's great. Is there any courses that are, or any teachers trying to integrate this or a visit to this place or a future visit to this place in their courses?
Yeah, in fact, there already has been integration with course classes, MAC campus classes with this project. We have ecological recording devices to monitor an increase in biodiversity as this project progresses. And the sound data has already been collected by a group of students and is now being analyzed to track what types of birds are present in this environment. So that will be an important basis of information for us to have so that in the following summers, as we record more bird sound, hopefully we'll be able to hear an increase in the biodiversity in this area. And then on top of that, there's professors who are interested in bringing their students here to monitor the native pollination or the meadow type ecosystem, which is not very available. There's research, ornithology, all types of classes that are interested in participating.
The Mac Bee Club, they weren't necessarily involved?
A lot of the clubs on campus have had a hard time sustaining themselves because of the pandemic. There was senior students who left and had a hard time getting new students engaged because no one was on campus. So we were in contact with the Bee Club, and they advised us, they helped us with some information and coming up with some ideas, but they've had a hard time with their continuity this year. So if there's anybody who wants to run Apiculture Club, you should let them know.
Cool. And is there a plan for signage in the future about the project?
For sure. We're going to be working on that type of development over this winter. We're going to be implementing information signs about the project, about what it is, who our funders are, who we're grateful to, and then also include some information about the different species that this ecosystem provides services to and what some of the different important plants are that are present in the meadow, just for informational reasons and educational reasons.
Excellent. Okay, well, thank you so much for telling me about this great project today, Alex.
Yeah, thank you so much for coming out to see it.
And that was my interview with Alex Kuiper-Dixon, who is the project leader of the McDonald Campus Pollination Meadow, which is a project which is receiving funding from the Sustainability Projects Fund of McGill University. And it's also actually receiving funding from the City of St. Anne de Bellevue's Moving Towards Sustainability Fund. If you want to find out more about the project, I believe you can go to mcgill.ca/sustainability, and you can find the projects that have been funded by the Sustainability Projects Fund. And just look for the McDonald Campus Pollinator Meadow Project, and you can even look at their application and see how much money they received and see who is involved in the project. So check that out. You are listening to Ecolibrium on CKUT 90.3 FM. This is your host, Ryan Young. So obviously these crazy floods have recently happened in the province of British Columbia. And it's gotten to the point where every major highway in BC going into the city of Vancouver is basically closed in some part of it because of a river that has taken out a road, or a river that has taken out a bridge, or a landslide has covered the highway in debris. And there have been a number of deaths. The sort of death count, the death count keeps going up as they find more victims under these mudslides and so on. And there has been a lot of discussion about how flooding has been made worse by the practice of clear-cut logging in BC. And recently, I found a really great discussion of this issue on YouTube, and it's called Clear-Cut Logging and the BC Floods, and I encourage you to check it out. The name of the gentleman is Daniel J. Pierce, and he made a documentary called Waterlogged. You can find his stuff on YouTube by going to the channel Heartwood Documentary, and it's a documentary like tree at the end instead of, it's spelled T-R-E-E, so documentary. But yeah, he does this great description on YouTube recently of showing the areas that were most negatively affected by flooding, like around Merritt, BC, and showing the crazy amount of clear-cut logging that has happened there since 1984. So he starts with a satellite image of what it looked like in 1984 and then goes up to the present day. And it is shocking. I personally can't believe that the province of British Columbia has allowed their forests to be so liquidated. You know, you don't realize it if you're driving around BC because it's well hidden from highways, from major highways and so on. But, you know, if you go up into the air, you see how bad the situation is. And what has been replaced mainly in these areas? Tree farms, not the original ecosystem that existed there, but, you know, favoring one particular type of species, and even using herbicides to kill any other species that compete. You know, and some people who do tree planting think that they're doing something good for the planet in BC. You're just part of the problem. You're creating these tree farms that do not support the same amount of biodiversity. In fact, I think they support very low numbers of biodiversity. What would be better, in fact, is just to leave the forest to recover on its own. From my understanding, it would, you know, be filled with all kinds of flowering plants and berry bushes for the first while before eventually it went back to its mature ecosystem, mature forest ecosystem. But before we get into more discussion about clear-cut logging and the forestry practices, of course, there's been a lot of civil disobedience against logging in BC. For example, the whole thing happening in Fairy Creek on Vancouver Island, where there's an attempt to save the last remaining old-growth forest. Apparently, BC has something like 1% left of its old-growth forests. You know, there's been a lot of protests against the logging. But of course, there's also been a lot of protests against some of these oil or gas pipelines. And on the show before, we have covered the Wet'suwet'en blockade of a particular pipeline in northern BC. And recently, armed RCMP were once again invading Wet'suwet'en traditional territory and dismantling a roadblock that was put up to stop the Coastal GasLink pipeline being constructed by TC Energy. The occupation apparently started in September again, and it halted the company's efforts to build a key portion of the pipeline. And Democracy Now! Covered this recent assault by the RCMP, highly armed with automatic weapons, going in to arrest these protesters. So here she is speaking with land defender and matriarch of a particular clan of the Wet'suwet'en Nation, and that's Molly Wickham. And she was one of the witnesses to the police raid. So here is the Democracy Now! Story now.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In Canada, heavily militarized officers with the Royal Canadian Mounted Police raided Wet'suwet'en territory Thursday with assault rifles and dogs, trying to put an end to a 50-day Indigenous blockade to block TransCanada's 400-mile, $4.7 billion Coastal GasLink pipeline. At least 14 people were arrested. The raid came on the same day Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau met with President Biden at the White House as 18,000 residents of British Columbia remain cut off by floodwaters and mudslides after torrential rains brought what officials have described as a 1-in-500-year flood. The Wet'suwet'en occupation started in September and halted the company's efforts to build a key portion of the over 400-mile pipeline that would transport natural gas from Dawson Creek in northeastern British Columbia to the province's north coastal region. On Thursday, Molly Wickham, an Indigenous land defender, recorded this video during the police raid.
The RCMP are invading Wet'suwet'en territory once again. There have been approximately 15 arrests that have happened already at Skidham Den checkpoint. Legal observers, media have been arrested. Two of our Wet'suwet'en elders have been arrested and removed from the territory. Right now we're at Coyote Camp and the RCMP are moving in to remove me from my territory. This invasion, once again, speaks to the genocide that's happening to Indigenous people that are trying to protect our water for our future generations. It's infuriating. It's illegal, even according to their own means of colonial law. We need to shut down Canada. Our Haudenosaunee relatives have been arrested, violently arrested. They've been removed from our territories. They're removing Wet'suwet'en people from our own lands. They're planning to drill under Wet'suwet'en and destroy our sacred headwaters. We need people to act. You need to act where you are now. Shut down major infrastructure. Do whatever you can. Rally against the investors. Shut down the investors to this project so that it is very clear that Indigenous people will not stand for the genocide that's happening to our lands and to our future generations.
Thursday's raid came after the Wet'suwet'en Nation issued its own eviction notice on Sunday to Coastal GasLink workers. When the workers attempted to access the roads, Indigenous land defenders refused to allow them to enter. The workers then reported the blockade to the Royal Canadian Mounted Police and issued an injunction.
Roads closed.
Roads closed, man, no matter what you say.
So we're here from Coastal GasLink Project. We are here to conduct work on behalf of the Coastal GasLink Project, and you're impeding us. Can you please move your blockade out of the area?
Nothing to say.
We have a court injunction, BC, asking that anyone having no are restrained from and physically restricting conducting work. Will you remove your blockade to conduct our work? As you're not removing your blockade and continuing to we'll be advising that we will be reporting this to the RCMP as a breach of injunction order. There's a copy of the injunction. Thank you for your time.
The Indigenous land defenders then burned the injunction in a bonfire. For more, we go to Molly Wickham, also known as Slato. She's a land defender matriarch of the Gedemten clan of Wet'suwet'en Nation. We heard describing the raid as it happened. She's a leader in this protracted battle against the pipeline. Molly, welcome back to Democracy Now! Describe more in detail what has taken place, the raid yesterday, and what this means, why you've been devoting scores of days to this.
Yeah, so today is day 56 of the occupation of the drill pad site. There were Coastal GasLink plans to drill underneath Wudzinkwa, which is our sacred headwaters, one of our last clean drinking water sources, our major spawning salmon river. No consent to drill under Wudzinkwa or cross Wudzinkwa whatsoever by our nation. On Sunday, November 14th, the Coastal GasLink was given 8 hours notice to evacuate the territory based on an eviction order by the hereditary chiefs of the Wet'suwet'en Nation of all five clans in January of 2020. And so this was an enforcement of that order in order to show Coastal GasLink and the investors and the people that are, supporting this project, that this project does not have the free, prior, informed consent of the Wet'suwet'en people. And so we provided the workers from the man camp 8 hours to vacate the territory. All of the vehicles were allowed out of the territory. Right as the deadline was approaching, the RCMP called Chief Wass and asked for a 2-hour extension, which Chief Wass granted to them. So they had 10 hours to leave the territory before the road was closed. And after, they did not make one move to try to leave the territory. We were informed later that Coastal GasLink workers, not all of them, were told by Coastal GasLink and instructed to leave the territory or that they would be blocked in. And so nobody left. They all stayed there voluntarily. And then the road was closed after 10 hours of giving them the opportunity to leave.
Can you talk about the corporation directly that's involved and its relationship to the Canadian government?
Yeah, so the corporation, the owners are the TC Energy, KKR, which is a private equity investment firm, and AIMCO, which is an investment firm as well from Alberta, which actually is caught up with Alberta RCMP pension funds. And so TC Energy owns the least amount, and there's also the major investors are the major five Canadian banks that are, and RBC, Royal Bank of Canada, is the one funding most of the construction for this project. And so there's a lot of Canadian pension funds that are invested in these private equity firms that are paying, that own this company. Around the world, there's huge investment into this company that people aren't even aware that it's their pension funds that are paying for this destruction of our territory.
On Wet'suwet'en territory, the Gedemten clan set up a cabin on the drill pad site where Coastal GasLink plans to drill.
This is the drill pad site where they plan to drill under Wudzinkwa. And we have a new home here, a new cabin here, a log cabin that's going to be here and stay here. And we'll be housing Kasia and Gedemden and Wet'suwet'en people for generations to come. And they won't be coming in here anytime soon to be drilling under Wudzinkwa. We're occupying this space. People are going to be living here, and it'll be occupied from now on.
Is that where you are right now, Slato?
Yes, we are at Coyote Camp, which is the drill pad site. Denise A. Wass, our house chief for our Cassia house of the Gedemden clan, his daughter is currently residing in that cabin at Coyote Camp. And we are holding down. Coyote Camp has not been raided. We just heard on the communications that there are two buses of RCMP headed out our way right now on the Forest Service Road. And we're still here, and we're holding this space as long as we possibly can. Yesterday, there was 30 to 50 militarized RCMP that entered Gedemden Checkpoint, which is another Gedemden occupation site 20 kilometers down the Forest Service Road from us. And they brought a canine unit, they had helicopters, they had assault rifles, sniper rifles, You know, in previous years, they had lethal overwatch, and I'm sure that was the case yesterday. Again, there were violent arrests made. Two of our elders were arrested and removed from the territory. One, which was denied her, our matriarch in our house, was denied her medication after an exclusion zone was set up by the RCMP. And then she was sent to hospital yesterday with chest pains because she had not received her heart medication.
Last year in Ontario, a Mohawk solidarity protest shut down the Canadian National Railway for days, halting travel for tens of thousands of passengers. I want to turn to Prime Minister Justin Trudeau responding to the solidarity protests.
We recognize the important democratic right, and we will always defend it, of peaceful protest. This is an important part of our democracy in Canada. But we're also a country of the rule of law, and we need to make sure those laws are respected. That is why I am encouraging all parties to dialogue to resolve this as quickly as possible.
So if you could respond to what Prime Minister Trudeau is saying. He just met yesterday with President Biden and the Mexican President AMLO, Andres Manuel López Obrador. He's pushing for Line 5 through Michigan, which the Michigan governor has said no to, afraid it'll pollute the Great Lakes. Overall, your message, this in the midst of, in another part of British Columbia, you have these 1-in-500-year floods.
Yeah, so I do want to speak to Trudeau's rule of law. I feel like the rule of law is inherently racist. And when they use that terminology in this context, it's extremely racist because it does not consider Indigenous law. It's as if we don't exist as Indigenous people and that we don't have our own governance and that we don't have our own system of law. And calling the rule of law and following the rule of law in Canada totally erases us as Indigenous people. And we are here holding up Wet'suwet'en law. That is why we are here. We are not here. We're not protesters. We're not just here protesting, you know, this one project. We're here to uphold Wet'suwet'en law as we have for thousands of years. And that means protecting our river at all costs. At this time, there's a, you know, BC declared a state of emergency. And so there are people literally stranded on their roofs. There are people that have died. And the RCMP have sent in 2 plane loads, 4 buses full, and multiple helicopters to use in raiding our territory on unarmed Indigenous people. And so that to me, that, you know, this climate crisis that has caused this disaster, and the resources that the government is willing to direct to criminalizing Indigenous people instead of addressing the actual climate issue speaks to, you know, the discrepancy between
Molly
what is
Wickham,
being said in the
we're
government.
We're going to have to leave it there. Also known as SLEDO, we'll continue to cover this issue. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
And that was a story from Democracy Now! About yet another police raid into Wet'suwet'en traditional territory to try and break up the Indigenous-led blockade of the multi-billion dollar Coastal GasLink pipeline, which is being constructed by TC Energy. You can find out more by going to democracynow.org. And back to the issue of logging in BC. We're on that topic because of the historic flooding in BC and how clear-cut logging has exacerbated that problem, has caused a lot of these landslides because the trees are no longer in place to absorb all that water. And to give us an idea of how things have gotten so bad in BC when it comes to the management of forestry, we go to something that comes out of BC, which I believe is supported by Simon Fraser University. Yeah, it comes from their Center for Dialogue. And they have a series called Conversations That Matter, which is hosted by the veteran broadcaster Stuart McNish. And here, back in, I think it was 2018, he interviews a representative from the BC Coalition for Forestry Reform. And that coalition also included Taryn Scalbania of the Peachland Watershed Protection Alliance. So here, Taryn Scalbania is being interviewed by veteran broadcaster Stuart McNish about the practice of forestry in British Columbia and what the problems are and why the government of British Columbia needs to change the rules and regulations around forestry practices in their province.
Margaret Mead said, "Never doubt that a small group of thoughtful, committed citizens can change the world. It's the only thing that ever has." That statement epitomizes bare-knuckled democracy. It's underway right now in 21 communities in British Columbia. Communities that are fed up and they're not going to take it anymore. They've come together to petition the provincial government to change regulations that favor resource developers over local citizens, local governments, and the environment. The BC Coalition for Forestry Reform says it's time to put an end to a Campbell government regulation that handed land use oversight back to the companies that are logging and mining on Crown lands. The regulation is called professional reliance or self-regulation. Since its introduction more than 15 years ago, the coalition says watersheds have come under attack and there's nothing local governments can do to stop it. The coalition contends professional reliance puts logging companies in a conflict of interest. They say, how can a company be entrusted to protect the very environment it utilizes to make money? When that happens, the environment is a regular loser. We invited Terrence Galbania of the Peachland Watershed Protection Alliance to join us for a conversation that matters about the right to roll up your sleeves and make sure your government represents everyone's interests. Welcome.
Thank you.
We find ourselves in an interesting situation right now. The provincial government has asked for a response to this professional reliance legislation that exists. Let's talk about what that is and then where you think we need to go. So what is professional reliance?
It's known by its opponents as the fox running the hen house.
The fox running the hen house, yeah.
Yes, and being a farmer, I know all that, what that means. But it's the industries in BC being regulated by the people who work for the industry. Mm-hmm. So, for example, logging, the foresters making the rules and being responsible for monitoring the logging industry.
Okay, so on the outside when you say mm-hmm. that, I go, okay, so I would want foresters making those rules. Mm-hmm. But it's a little bit more than that, isn't it? It's the foresters who are working for the forest company.
Yes. They're being paid to do work that may or may not benefit the rest of the environment or the communities that they're working in. They're being paid to get the best price of wood and to get the best amount of wood out. The cheapest.
You're being very cautious about saying it is a conflict of interest.
It's
that's what you see it as a conflict of interest.
Yes, I do. A lot of people do. I do too. Yes.
And so why? Like, why does that become a conflict of interest? We need, let's say, professionals in particular industries to be on top of this. Mm-hmm. They have to have a commitment to the industry. What is it about the current situation that causes you so much concern? And where's the evidence to back it up?
I don't think that all professionals in our industry are like this. Say, for example, a doctor or an engineer, you know, they're more precautionary. It's a doctor's job to keep people alive or keep airplanes in the air, so they take a more cautionary approach. Whereas in the forestry industry, it's less precautions are taken. It's more about dollars, the bottom line. So gambles are taken and it eventually will catch up in our environment.
Well, you say you've seen it happen where you call home, Peachland. Tell me what's going on there. And why does it start to cause you concern that, okay, they're carrying out their duties for a forest company. Okay, so what? But where does it start to cross the line and have an impact on the community?
We have a water treatment system, and legally, the District of Peachland has to supply water to its 5,000 inhabitants. Mm-hmm. However, they have no say in what happens in the watershed.
How's that possible?
Well, it's Crown land, and the government has given 100% of control to the logging companies. The foresters and licensees have more control in a community watershed than the community. They tell you where they're logging, when they're logging, what they're logging, how they're logging, and we have no say. They advise us, but the District of Peachland or a regional district or any jurisdiction has no say in what happens to the logging in the area.
So I thought the Forest Practices Code that was brought in by the Mark Harcourt government going back to the 1990s mm-hmm. would have addressed all of these kinds of issues, because, you know, when you took a look at the stack of recommendations or regulations mm-hmm. that came with all of that,
I was under the impression that all these things had been addressed because they were so concerned about preserving habitat, and not just for fish, but everywhere. What happened?
Well, in 2000, that great document, the Forestry Practices Code, was thrown out. It did have its problems too, but in the interest of saving money and reducing the amount of labor as far as forest rangers and foresters in the government, they adopted something called the Forestry and Range Practices Act, which gave the power to the professionals in the logging industry.
So they actually took the power out of the hands of the regulators and gave it to the users.
Exactly. There's no more Ministry of Forests. It became Ministry of Forests, Lands, Natural Resources, and they also added, you know, agricultural land use in there. And there's actually a little passage in the Forestry Range Practices Act that people who are opposing things like logging have no say if it unduly reduces the amount of timber supply. So we can say all we want. If they can ruin our water system, we can say, please don't. But if it ruins their timber supply or reduces their timber supply, we have no say.
Huh. Were you paying attention to this as it happened?
No.
No.
Not at first, no. And we're like, there's 488 community watersheds in British Columbia. So everybody lives in a watershed or an airshed or a soil shed. However, there's more and more ongoing communities having issues with their water system. More and more communities having to build expensive water treatment plants because the effects of logging in their watersheds.
So what's happening? You say they're building, you know, roads and they're logging. So what's been the impact on community watersheds?
Well, anytime you deforest, whether naturally or
through forest fire,
bug kill, landslides happen naturally. Those are enough threats. But you bring in logging, clear cuts, and road building. It's the road building especially that impacts watersheds, because all runoff is channeled into ditches and culverts, and that it really accelerates.
And then it continues on downhill.
Yeah. And we had a ditch in Peachland. It wasn't there last year, but this year it was 2 kilometers long, and you could drive your Jeep through it.
Through the ditch
on the side of a road. Yeah, and where that water came from, we don't know. Where all that soil went, well, it's eventually now in Lake Okanagan. But amazing amount of power behind runoff. Mm-hmm. When you speak to industry professionals, they'll tell you, well, it was Mother Nature, it was an extreme weather year, weather-related event. But when you speak to other critics, they said it has a lot to do with the accelerated pace of clear-cut logging in the Okanagan, especially in steep, critical watersheds. Like, our terrain is really steep already, so we already get natural mudslides. And yes, they have rules in this Forestry Range Practices Act of how much clear cutting can be allowed in certain areas, certain elevations. But again, the professionals are monitoring it are the ones that would benefit from having these clear cut areas. So there's
benefit from not impeding the total amount of wood that's being output.
And they all go to university and they're all foresters, but they're taught in this university of a sustainable forestry model, which a lot of critics question as well, because we have yet to clear cut, harvest, replant, and clear cut again. That whole model hasn't happened yet. We've only been clear cutting in the 70s. They've just started reforestation. So these trees that are at the most are 50 years old, at the most, are at 5 to 6 inches to a foot a year of growth. So at the most, they're 50 feet tall. Let's say, for example, in the Okanagan, they grow much slower. In the coast or Vancouver Island, it's a different scenario. So they should have different rules everywhere. So these trees are now, say, 50 feet tall. There should be logged when they're 80 to 100, 120 feet. That's what a good pine tree is. That's what they're looking for. But with other variables like climate change and this extreme weather, who knows if they're going to be getting these trees that are ready to be harvested again. So to call the logging industry sustainable is a guess. You know, I'm a farmer. I know if I plant something and harvest it and replant, it'll take me a whole season of grow to know if that's sustainable, what I'm doing.
Mm-hmm.
And they haven't had that yet. They don't know if it's sustainable. There's no scientific data to back this up.
Well, I wish you all the best of luck.
Oh, thank you for
coming in and sharing this, what I consider to be a very important conversation.
Good. Thank you very much for the invitation.
And so that was an excerpt from Conversations That Matter, which is a series which comes out of Simon Fraser University Center for Dialogue that features broadcaster Stuart McNish interviewing people about various issues of concern to British Columbians. And that was Terence Galbania from the Peachland Watershed Protection Alliance. You can check out their website at peachlandwpa.org. So that's the Peachland Watershed Protection Alliance, and you can find them at peachlandwpa.org. You are listening to Equilibrium on CKUT 90.3 FM. We're basically out of time, so we're going to bid you farewell for today. You can always email us at equilibrium@ckut.ca. You can also find us on Facebook at facebook.com/EquilibriumCKUT Montreal. And we do have a website, which is equilibriumradio.weebly.com, which has a link to our SoundCloud page. And we also have a related podcast on Spotify, which is called the Equilibrium Radio Podcast. I'm Ryan Young, and we're going to leave you with some music. This is, I think, one of the most amazing songs I ever heard about forestry issues and the protests against clear-cut logging in British Columbia was a song by the Weird Sisters. They have a song called Farewell to Clackwood Sound, of course, which was a big protest movement back in the 80s or 90s, I believe, trying to save a part of British Columbia's Vancouver Island, where there was a high concentration of old-growth forest in the area around Tofino, which is called Clackwood Sound. And the Weird Sisters put out this amazing song back then, which, you know, it's a great song, sometimes sends shivers up my spine. So enjoy. Have a great rest of your day.
On Vancouver Island, forest so old, the last of her kind. She is mighty and bold, but the big blades now are mowing her down. Farewell, farewell to Clackwood Sound. Well, the NDP had made a big noise, trying to play the big games with all the big boys. So they sold out her soul for hardly a cent. The raw timber's cut and elsewhere is sent. So blow the bridge down in the dead of the night. Sink it into the ground for the sake of the soul of Clackwood Sound. Take a deep breath and blow the bridge down. Upwards of thousands have stood in the way, but bullies just come and take them each day. And the government too has its own saws. They're changing the charges by changing the laws. So blow the bridge down in the dead of the night. Sink it into the ground for the sake of the soul of Clackwood Sound. Breath and blow the bridge down. live in the trees? What of the life, the quiet, the breeze? And what of our planet when she's stripped to the ground? Farewell, farewell to Clackwet Sound. So blow the bridge down, blow the bridge down in the dead of the night. Sink it into the ground for the sake of the soul of Clackwet Sound. Take a deep breath and blow the bridge down. Blow the bridge down, blow the bridge down in the dead of the night. Sink it into the ground for the sake of the soul. Clackwet Sound, take a deep breath and blow the bridge down, friends, blow the bridge down in the dead of the night, sink it into the ground for the sake.
The following is a previously broadcast program.
This is Lukey D. Real food you want. Come to Mango Bay every day. Real food.
Mango Bay Restaurant, located in the heart of downtown Montreal, 1236 Mackay Street, Suite 201. For reservations, please call 514-875-7082 or visit mangobay.ca. Real food. Let's go.